This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.
Space riddle. A space scientist incinerated in his Tesla as a UFO whistleblower found dead. Tonight, the toll rising to 14. Good evening. I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. I want to thank you for being with us.
A number of them have gone missing with the same circumstances, leaving Apple Watch and phone behind.
He's literally a walking hard drive of highly classified information. So the FBI is going to be very, very interested in determining what exactly has happened to him.
How can these not be connected? How does a young scientist, without telling family or friends, decide he's going on a trip, get into his Tesla without his wallet or iPhone, like so many of the other missing or dead scientists, leaving home on foot, leaving behind all ID, wallets, cell phones, tracking devices, any sort of identification that links them to the military or to their research. This young scientist, Joshua LeBlanc, leaves home and suddenly crashes into a guardrail, and both he and his vehicle are totally incinerated. Joining us, an all-star panel, but first, straight out to Stephanie Harlow, co-host Crime Weekly, and you can find her at Stephanie Harlow. Stephanie, thank you for being with us tonight. What happened to Joshua LeBlanc? First of all, tell me about him. What was he studying? Let me guess, anti-gravity, jet propulsion, what?
Yes, jet propulsion. He lived and worked in Huntsville, Alabama, which is kind of the epicenter of a lot of these missing people, including Dr. Ning Lee, who was missing for a while but ended up being killed, and also Amy Eskridge. So the University of Huntsville is very, very focused on NASA, jet propulsion, anti-gravity research. That's the epicenter of where all that stuff is happening. But he did work with some pretty high security clearance.
Very quickly, I want to go to John Nance, former supervisory special agent, FBI, assigned to D.C. and Miami. Got a question for you, John Nance. Explain the significance of anti-gravity research. As a layperson, the best way I can describe it is we obey the laws of gravity. We understand them. Anti-gravity research as it relates to aircraft of any type means that an aircraft could go up, down, to the side, tangential, any way it wished, and at speeds unlike anything we understand. So how valuable is it? Did I capsulize it correctly?
Well, when you're talking about anti-gravity or field propulsion systems, you're not really talking about pushing a craft through space. You're talking about actually moving space and time around a craft. So a bubble is created, and I don't know exactly how that. I'm sure there are other people that could address that in much more technical terms than I can. But essentially, a space-time bubble is created around the craft if such technology is actually available. And so you're actually moving, warping space and time around the craft. That's why they appear to move in ways that are completely alien to our understanding of physics, or at least material science anyway. I think our physics can explain it, but our material science is in no way capable at this point of producing that kind of performance. So I think generally speaking, yes, you're correct. But it's not the normal way of thinking about like a jet engine works by sucking in air, producing thrust, and blowing that out the back of an engine. That is not what we're talking about.
Exactly. Anti-gravity craft, as I understand it, highly advanced aerospace vehicles designed, and they manipulate gravity fields for propulsion. The most cited example is the TR-38 Black Manta. It's rumored to be a triangular nuclear-powered spy plane using accelerated pressurized mercury, and it creates a plasma-based anti-gravity field around it, just as John Nance was describing. It's beyond what us regular old trial lawyers are used to discussing. But needless to say, back to Stephanie Harlow, co-host star of Crime Weekly, it's incredibly valuable, not just to our defense, but financially to our government, to whatever private entity or corporation ultimately develops it. And there's high interest in foreign entities regarding U.S. research in anti-gravity. Now, I've gone a little far afield, but that said, Stephanie Harlow, that is what Joshua LeBlanc was studying.
Yes, I mean, if you could learn how to manipulate gravity, even in a small way, it would change the game completely for everything. It would change everything, architecture, travel, military weapons, obviously, and the privatized business fields like Tesla, SpaceX, Blue Origin. But Joshua LeBlanc was studying propulsion. They're always trying to study a different way of propulsion, because most of a jet or a plane or a rocket that goes into space is 85% fuel. So if you could figure out a way to reduce that fuel payload, then obviously you could go further, you could go faster. So they have a lot of people at NASA and the Jet Propulsion Lab and all over the military and government trying to figure out how to manipulate gravity and find a better way of propulsion.
That said, Stephanie Harlow, we have a NASA nuclear engineer burned beyond recognition in his Tesla. What happened that morning?
So Joshua LeBlanc left his house pretty early, and like a lot of the other scientists on this list that we're talking about, he left his wallet behind, he left his phone behind, and then he drove his Tesla to the Huntsville airport, which was about 15 minutes away from his home. And that's where it sat for 4 hours. Before he started driving about another 2 hours, and then randomly, for no reason that we can figure out, crashed his Tesla directly into a guardrail. The car caught on flames, and by the time they got there, they said the car was incinerated and the body inside of it was unrecognizable. And Joshua LeBlanc's family, they want Tesla to give them video, because the Tesla has video, especially if there's a crash that deploys the airbags, where they will take short video, but they don't store them in the cloud. They're usually in the USB that's kept in the Tesla. If the car was burned beyond recognition, that's obviously destroyed, but Tesla would still have a way to retrieve that video. Joshua LeBlanc's family does not think that he did this on his own, and they suspect foul play, as do I.
NASA nuclear engineer Joshua LeBlanc, nearly 30, just 29, in the midst of highly sensitive research, burned beyond recognition in the wreckage of his Tesla Model 3 there near the Space Center in Huntsville, Alabama. Family report him missing 4:32 a.m. that day. It wasn't until 2:45 p.m. his car was found. I find it very concerning. Let me understand this, Stephanie Harlow, that he drove without his wallet or ID or driver's license or cell phone to the airport and sat there for hours, or at least his car did. Did he meet anyone? Why did he just sit in a parking lot for hours?
I'm not sure. I think that's what his family wants to know as well, because Joshua didn't show up for work that morning, and that was very unlike him. He was good at his job. He was having a very advanced career, especially for his age. He was brilliant. He talked to his family and friends every single night online. They gamed together. They talked together. This was not a person who any of what he did that day made sense. And I think that it's important to understand that there have been and there are verifiable CIA document leaks called Vault 7 that WikiLeaks published years ago. And in those document leaks, it shows that the CIA is exploring how to remotely hijack vehicles to undertake what they have said, in their words, not mine, nearly undetectable assassinations. So when you see something like this, what happened to Joshua LeBlanc, I think your brain goes there. I know mine did immediately.
Straight out to Dave Matt, Crime Stories investigative reporter. Is it true that it took 3 days to identify his body?
It did, Nancy. His body was brought to the Alabama Department of Forensic Sciences, but even with everything at their disposal, it took 3 full days to positively identify LeBlanc.
Okay, straight out to Dr. Kendall Crowns joining us. Dr. Crowns is the chief medical examiner, not a medical examiner, the chief medical examiner at Tarrant County. That's Fort Worth, Texas. He is a star of a hit podcast, Mayhem in the Morgue. And more importantly, he is an esteemed lecturer at the Burnett School of Medicine at TCU and has performed literally over 10,000 medical autopsies. Dr. Kendall Crowns, thank you for being with us tonight. Dr. Crowns, why 3 days to identify his body? I mean, they knew it was his Tesla, number one. The family reported him missing. Why did it take 3 days to figure out it's him?
Well, actually, 3 days is a little surprising to me because I would think it would take even longer. If a body is burned beyond recognition, meaning that the facial skin has been burned away all the way to the bone, you have to do techniques to figure out who they are. And one of them is dental records. So they have a presumptive ID. They kind of know who he is. They get his dental records and do a comparison. 3 days is, to me, an actually quick turnaround time. So I'm not surprised it took that long, but they are going to have to do techniques that are going to take a little longer because he's burned beyond recognition.
Okay, Dr. Kendall Crowns, I know I'm wading into dangerous territory here, arguing with the chief medical examiner in a metropolitan area, but how hard is it to get dental records? The family says that's his car. He's missing. Dental records? That should take a couple of hours?
Well, it isn't a couple hours. You have to call the dentist. They have to get the records. They have to bring them to the medical examiner's office. So you're looking at least a day or two.
Whoa. You do know about email, right? You don't have to get in on your horse and buggy and go over to the medical examiners. You hit one button and send it. Okay, so that takes 5 minutes. The family says, that's his vehicle. He's missing. Here's his dentist. I still don't get what you're saying. Are you saying the teeth were incinerated too?
The teeth can be incinerated in cases to the point that they'll crush when you move the body. But let's say you get the email in a day, and then you have to have a dental professional review the case. It isn't something where the medical examiner can pull up the dental x-rays and make the comparison. You have to get a dental professional, a forensic dentist, to then make the comparison. And they may not be available that day. It might take them a little while to come in. So again, 3 days, that's pretty impressive for someone that's been burned beyond recognition. Just because it's his car, you don't know if it's him driving it. You have to make sure and do your due diligence to make sure you got the right body and to make the decision and to make the identification.
I am not suggesting that anyone cut corners in the ID of a dead body at all. I'm saying that with the family saying he's missing, that's his car, there's a dead body in there, they can't get his dental records like that. You know, instant email or even text. But what you're saying regarding bringing in a forensic dental specialist, that suddenly makes sense to me. Another issue out to special guest joining us, Frank Milburn, former British intelligence officer who knew another dead scientist very well, Amy Eskridge. I find this also incredibly interesting. A Tesla, as you know, very rarely bursts into flames. It's an electric vehicle less likely to burst into flames compared to gas vehicles, which burst into flames 60 times more than electrics. And I also find it interesting that when Joshua LeBlanc's parents were told about this, at first, they thought he had been abducted. When he went missing, he was so reliable and so regular. You know those people that never miss work, ever? They're there when you get there, making the coffee. Them? That's Joshua LeBlanc. When they found out that he did not report to work, They could not hear from him. They reported him missing at 4:30 in the morning. I find that very, very probative. That would be like the camera coming to me and I'm not here. That never happens. That has never happened. See where I'm going with this, Frank?
Yes, when you have something that runs contrary to a subject, an individual's sort of established patterns of life, something that really stands out that is contrary to what they normally do, the way that they normally behave, the way they normally live, the places that they normally go to. Yes, that would be deeply suspicious. But the issue of the vehicle, I can't speculate as to the cause of it. What I can say is that vehicular tampering, sabotage, is something that Amy Eskridge experienced many times. And after she died, other scientists came forward to me anonymously saying that their vehicles had been tampered with as well, as in brakes, to make the vehicle effectively dangerous for them to drive.
Let me see Frank Milburn, please. Former British intelligence officer who knew scientist Amy Eskridge very well, who said point blank, if I am found dead, I did not and would never commit suicide. So, Frank, I've had those words from murder victims before, typically in domestic homicide cases, where they would tell their friends, hey, if I'm ever found dead, he did it. I just know that. So I find it very disturbing that she said that repeatedly. And tonight we're playing some of her recordings, yet seemingly no one is taking her self-inflicted gunshot wound seriously. But back to Joshua LeBlanc. I'm going to circle back, Frank, with you and those recordings. Dr. Kendall Crown, so assuming that the comparison was made and the body ID'd through dental records, how does that happen? And do you lose all of your DNA in an incineration of that sort?
So let's start with how the DNA or the dental records are compared. We will take the body at the time of autopsy and do a full dental x-ray. We usually have the equipment to do that. And then those are given to the dentist to make a comparison. They usually look at fillings. If there's no fillings, they'll look at root structures of the teeth and pulp cavities to make that identification. And then can a person be incinerated to the point that there's no DNA? Yes, if you get the temperature high enough for a long period of time, over 1,000 degrees, you basically will cremate the body and destroy all the DNA. And these Tesla fires, the problem is they're hard to put out because those lithium batteries keep burning and the firefighters need to use special techniques to put them out. So they're a very long period of time that they're burning. So it's potential he could have been burned to the point that there's no DNA, but he has to have been turned to ash at that point. So if there's still parts of the body left, usually the bone marrow is still intact because it's pretty insulated by the fat and muscle and all that. So you could still get DNA from them. If there's a tooth still left, you can still get DNA. But if they get burned completely to ash, of course, there's no DNA left.
Take a look at him with the vehicle. That's the Tesla getting charged. So discussing the lithium batteries, that's a double-edged sword right there. Because, yes, Dr. Kendall Crowns, you're right about the immediate fire when the lithium batteries blow. But then there's also the statistic that hardly ever happens with a Tesla. It doesn't just burst into flames as opposed to gas-powered vehicles. What do you make of that, Dr. Crowns?
Well, that's correct, but I believe he hit something with his car, and that could put the lithium battery in peril for bursting into flames. So, again, you'd have to look into exactly what happened with the accident to figure out why his car caught on fire. But the problem, once the car catches on fire, the majority of them are made of plastic components and cloth, and they burn quite rapidly and quite quickly and very hot.
Straight out to Dave Matt, Crime Stories investigative reporter. Isn't it true? Here he is, like so many other of these scientists. I've got copious notes taken on every detail of their disappearances and deaths. Many of them just walk out the door without their wallet, their driver's license, their cell phone, their smartwatch that would track them, no identification linking them to the military. In fact, as I recall, McCasland left with no ID, no watch, no anything. He did have a gun with him. Interesting. Why did he think he needed to take a gun? But after his death, even his Air Force sweatshirt was found about 2 miles away on the side of the road. Anything that would have connected him to the military, gone. Same thing with LeBlanc. No ID, no nothing. No one would have known who he was if he had not been in that Tesla and his family had not reported him missing. It's my understanding that out of the blue, no suicidal ideation, no depression, no anything, was kind of excited about his research and his work. Dave Mack, what happened in the crash? I understand that he crashed through a guardrail and plowed into several trees.
That's exactly what happened. The initial impact in the Tesla was into the guardrail on the side of the road, but he went through the guardrail over the dirt and slammed directly into a couple of trees, Nancy, and that's where the inferno began, was right there in the tree line.
Now, we've learned from his LinkedIn page, he started working as an aerospace technologies electrical engineer at NASA, 2019. What they do? They design, develop, and test hardware and software used in spacecraft, used in satellites, and ground support systems. He also plays a role in the agency's Moon to Mars initiatives. I find it very interesting, Dave Mack. His family first believed he had been kidnapped when they reported him missing at 4:23 in the morning. It was so unlike him.
It's shocking to me that at 4:32 in the morning, his family is calling to report him missing. Look, I get it. Some people don't show up for work, but 4:30 in the morning is a very early and very specific time. And as you mentioned, his family thought abduction. So something else was going on that we haven't been told yet. But I mean, really, Nancy, I get going to work early, but being reported missing at 4:32 in the morning, that is a shocking revelation in this story to me, because something else was happening that we have not been told, or they wouldn't have done it.
Back to Dr. Kendall Crowns, you were discussing lithium batteries. They burn at 500 degrees Celsius, 1,000 degrees, between 500 and 1,000 degrees. Is that enough to totally incinerate the body beyond recognition?
Yes, it can be. I mean, if you sustain that 1,000 degrees for a long period of time, it will completely burn away the skin. It will cause what we say is it makes the skin kind of black and crisp like charcoal, and then it burns away to the bone. Then the bones, as they're being burned at this sustained heat, will become brittle and break. And again, at 1,000 degrees and higher, you're basically cremating him. And he's sitting in a metal box, which is going to keep that heat in and keep it going and circulating. And then, so it is, it's an environment that could easily burn him and burn him beyond recognition quite quickly.
The part that's very unusual, well, it's all unusual, is what Stephanie Harlow told us, the star of Crime Weekly, that he first went to the airport there in Huntsville and sat there for hours. Why? Doing what? Did he meet someone? Why was he driving around with no cell phone, no ID, no wallet, no anything? What happened in those hours? Was anyone with him? Did anyone get into that car? Did he have a burner phone? Is any of that caught on video? Airports are like Vegas casinos. They are covered with video cams. Where's the camera? Where's the video? As of yet, it has not emerged. Does it still exist? Which leads me to Frank Milburn, former British intelligence officer who knew another dead scientist, Amy Eskridge, very well. Frank, I'd like you to listen to her voice, to her tapes that you have provided to us. Listen.
We discovered what was up when we got back and the car battery was drained, the pepper spray was emptied, right? They just had a colonel walk out of the airport behind me. He didn't have any luggage. I don't think he even flew that day, right? My car failed to start, and then he offered to jump it for me. Right? So the colonel jumped my car, and then I went along my merry way. Totally traumatized, but also totally okay, right? I have not traveled by air, and I also have not left the city by car either ever since then.
From our friends at Daily Mail to Frank Milburn, what is she talking about?
Yeah, she's talking about an incident that happened when she came back from out of town, when she came back to her airport near Huntsville. And this is something that was recurring for her. She would go out of town, fly out, she'd come back. Her vehicle had been tampered with. Even when she didn't fly, her vehicle would be tampered with. So her vehicle would be in an airport car parking lot, where presumably there's cameras and there's surveillance people moving in and out. So you'd have, presumably you'd have some record of it. But her car was being tampered with. Whether it was products inside the car, items inside the car, or sometimes the door would just be left open ajar so that the battery would run down so that when she came back, she had a problem. But this was recurring, and it happened not only to her at airports, but also at other locations, and also including at home. And there's a video where she's very worried. She found footsteps outside her house. There's another one where she's talking about her car being, her mother's car being battery drained.
Also, allegations that her home computer had been hacked. Listen.
So I maybe just sent a message to Tim on LinkedIn and informed him that if I see one more illegally leaked document of photos that were taken from my laptop bag from my home by your business partner, I'm going to call the FBI. You've been informed that your partner has committed interstate felonies because he took pictures in Alabama, he transported them across state lines to New Jersey, and he posted them online from New Jersey. That's an interstate felony, considering the NDA. It's an act of corporate espionage because he founded a competing company right after that. It's an act of international espionage because he has a dual citizenship status. It's an act of breach of executive presidential privilege because the document is, addressed to Trump on the very first page. And are you aware that your business partner left a very messy trail of evidence about these multiple felonies that's extremely, extremely easy to prove in court?
Frank, what is she talking about? Do you believe her computer had been hacked?
That happened to her a lot, and she was regularly, for example, when she was attacked with directed energy weapons, which is well documented, she was working on an air-gapped computer precisely because she didn't want to be connected to the internet. Her team and her were constantly having to reinstall their phones, their computers, precisely because of this hacking. But in that particular case, here, that the person that she names in the clip that you played previously, he's been gaslighting me and her since before she died. He knew. I've got emails going back to, I've got documents going back to 2021 saying that she was being a target of industrial espionage by him and his partner. These people have been trying to gaslight her before and after her death and trying to portray her as crazy, as not competent. But this should be thoroughly investigated by the FBI. I know these people. They're trying to gaslight me too. So, this is actually disgusting behavior. Talking very, very badly about a deceased dead lady who can't defend herself. But that's why I'm here to defend her.
Well, you mentioned something very important to me, Frank, and that was that she was hired and cleared by the government and was actually working along with Homeland Security. I want to circle, and bottom line is, you have to go through so much. Isn't that true, John Nance, for her to get that type of clearance and to be working with Homeland Security and with the government on anti-gravity and jet propulsion research? She would have to be cleared out the yin-yang.
Yeah, I would think that she would at least have a TSSCI clearance and probably access to maybe SAP, like these very, very secure compartmentalized programs. Those clearances aren't just doled out, and the people that have those types of clearances are regularly assessed, as to their mental competence, financial stability, all that kind of stuff. So if she was working on those programs, then I can't imagine that she wouldn't have some of the most stringent security clearances that that the American government has. So all of this is incredibly disturbing, and I would think that this would be of great interest to the FBI, especially from a counterintelligence espionage perspective.
The reality, John Nance, when I'm looking at Amy Eskridge and Joshua LeBlanc, for instance, two of them, with the highest possible security clearance, they're working on government, actually secret government research, beyond anything that trial lawyers like myself have ever encountered. The government is not going to entrust people that are suicidal, have addiction problems, nothing like that.
Well, yeah, depending on the level of clearance. And like I said, these SAP programs, it's not technically a higher level than top secret. It's an access control mechanism. And depending on what type of SAP program someone has access to, the government will even monitor the type of medications that you're on. I mean, that's how sensitive we're talking about this stuff. There are also USAPs, which are unacknowledged special access programs, where a lot of this anti-grav technology is typically housed. So people that have access to this type of stuff, that are working on this stuff, are closely monitored. So you're absolutely correct. You know, her mental state would not be in question if she had those kinds of accesses.
And I'd like to point out, she is chalked off as a suicide, even though she swore before her death she would not commit suicide. Now you've got Joshua LeBlanc, no suicidal ideation, no depression, nothing, crashes his Tesla into a guardrail and dies again without any identification. Then Air Force Intelligence Officer Matthew James Sullivan died at home, Falls Church, Virginia, just months before he was to testify before Congress about secret government research programs. He died of an alleged accidental drug overdose. It was a deadly mix of prescription muscle relaxant, anti-anxiety, and even child anxiety drugs, a deadly cocktail. It was determined by Representative Eric Burleson in a letter to the FBI. The manner and circumstances of Sullivan's death raised substantial questions as he was preparing to provide testimony to Congress. And I'm quoting what Burleson said, but I want to circle back. That's three scientists approved by the government that die of suicide under very bizarre circumstances, had never been suicidal or even depressed, don't even miss work, ever. So back to Amy Eskridge. She began to notice odd details that were happening around her.
So whoever did that thought I was going to be landing alone because I bought my ticket separately, right? But then he decided to go with me at the last minute because he didn't feel comfortable with me flying alone, right? So he actually bought his ticket at the counter when we got there. So whoever did that thought I was flying in alone. But my side obviously noticed immediately, because when we got to the airport in Virginia to fly home, like, they just waved me through security, didn't check my ID, didn't check my ticket. They were like, leave your shoes on, don't take your bag off, just walk through the scanner, right? Like, they just wanted me to get behind the security barrier as quickly as humanly possible, right?
So I don't believe I have, since September 11, one time, Frank Milburn, not had to empty everything, take off every piece of metal, my running watch, you name it. I stripped down my children, everything, let them go through the metal detector. She noticed just before her death that she was waved through, and they said, don't take off your shoes. You don't have to empty anything. Just go. She started noticing odd details, odd things happening. She became concerned and afraid and stated point blank, if I die, I did not commit suicide.
Yes, that's correct. But I mean, also as far back as November 2021, because I've been going through all my old Signal files with her and I provided these to you. In November 2021, she's saying, look, I've had a really bad, hard life and a lot of bad things have happened to me. I'm in an incredible amount of pain from injuries that I've received. But I have every desire to go on living because I've got a mission to accomplish in life. And for her, that was everything, her work, her family, and the fact that she had this kind of like this inner drive and she wanted to bring her work effectively into the public sphere and out of the classified sphere to benefit all of us, all of mankind, basically. So she had this mission. She felt this kind of sense of destiny. And that was 7 months before she died, before she started sending out these desperate messages, to all her friends, to me and to others and to coworkers, to everybody who knew what was going on around her. A month before she died, saying, again, I won't commit suicide. I'm not going to overdose. I'm not going to take pills. I'm not going to shoot myself. I'm not going to kill anybody else. So, 7 months before she dies, she's saying, I have every reason to live. And then a month before she dies, she's saying, I'm not going to kill myself.
To you, Dave Mack, joining us, Crime Stories investigative reporter, I want to circle back to the fact that Sullivan, who we were describing earlier, was a whistleblower. What can you tell me? And just before he could testify, he ends up dead. No suicidal ideation, no depression, nothing. With top clearance. He also dies in his home. Accidental drug overdose. What is he doing with all those anti-anxiety meds? They wouldn't have him on board if he was taking all of that medicine. It wouldn't happen. He would not maintain that clearance. What happened, Dave Mack?
Well, Matthew Sullivan was scheduled to testify before Congress about, and I'm using the actual wording here, secret government UFO programs. This was a real hearing scheduled for Matthew Sullivan to talk about what he knew, firsthand experience. Now, this was a big deal. There was a lot going on with the concern about his death. Representative Eric Burleson, Nancy, labeled the mysterious death of Sullivan as a grave concern, implications of national security. So a lot more than meets the eye. It's not just him going in to talk about flying saucers in air quotes. But look at what he overdosed on, Nancy. Xanax, cyclobenzaprine, which is Flexeril, muscle relaxer, and a drug to treat children for bedwetting. That's what they say he overdosed on. I looked up the numbers, the amount that would have to be taken of those medications to overdose, and the numbers are astronomical. And as you mentioned, you don't get this kind of clearance in the military if you have suicidal ideation or an addiction to any of these types of situations. So Matthew Sullivan was planning on opening the door on some very classified and very secret UFO material that was important to the government of the United States of America, for the people to know anyway. And before that could happen, he died.
I only wonder if it had anything to do with anti-gravity jet propulsion. That said, I would be remiss if I did not mention physicist, brilliant physicist, Dr. Ning Li. She had been awarded $450,000 from the DOD, and she disappeared briefly. Then she was mowed down in a crosswalk. Nobody else went out in the crosswalk, but she was suddenly thrust into the crosswalk. She got mowed down. Her husband immediately had a heart attack and later died. She was brain dead and then later died. To Stephanie Hurlow joining us, co-host Crime Weekly podcast, what can you tell me about her? I know she's Chinese American, and I know that she was brilliant. And I know nobody but her ended up in that crosswalk when she got mowed down.
Dr. Ning Li worked at the University of Alabama in Huntsville, and she was doing anti-gravity work and research there. She then left the university after a significant amount of time there, and she started her own business. And then the government came calling, and they gave her that grant to work on continued anti-gravity research, because this is Huntsville. They do that stuff there, as well as advanced propulsion research. And then she started working with the government. And at that point, she kind of went dark. And there was a big thing online for a while because people thought she disappeared. She was off the map for quite a bit. And there was a journalist who was trying to find her to talk to her about her research. And he couldn't find her. And he reached out to another anti-gravity researcher, Eugene Polanak, and Eugene said, oh, she's working for the government. She just can't talk to anybody about what she's doing right now. But Eugene also said, I haven't been able to reach her either. And it was several years later when this same journalist finally tracked down Dr. Nangley's son. And the son said she had been hit. She had been in a terrible car accident, which had left her with permanent brain damage. She developed dementia. And then he took care of her for several years until she finally passed away from this. But she was never the same, obviously. She never went back to work.
You know what's interesting, Stephanie, is that Dr. Lee has been compared to Amelia Earhart. She is the Amelia Earhart of physics, the scientist that many people say, quote, discovered anti-gravity. That's the significance of who is Dr. Ning Lee. She was brilliant, but after being mowed down in a crosswalk, and I keep going back, John Nance joining me, former supervisory special agent with the FBI, to the fact that, for instance, in Manhattan, everybody walks out into the street when they think that they're not going to get run over. They don't look at the walk, don't walk signs. Okay. In this case in Huntsville, nobody else stepped out in the crosswalk. Nobody stepped out but her. And she got mowed down. Immediate, forever brain damage. She could never work as a physicist again after that.
There are simply too many data points to think that this is, you know, explainable by coincidence. The all these events that are surrounding, especially these, what we're calling the anti-grav technology, is simply the correlation is simply too strong to ignore. And it kind of reminds me of some of the things that the Bureau used to do back during the Cold War. In fact, agents assigned to counterintelligence functions would often tail KGB agents into the New York subway systems and quote unquote give them a bump, so to speak, as an intimidation tactic, kind of pushing them toward the subway. So what happened to her sounds, you know, hauntingly familiar to that type of thing. Obviously, FBI agents weren't trying to kill KGB agents, but, you know, not something that is certainly unheard of within intelligence or counterintelligence communities. So obviously incredibly suspicious, and we keep going back to people who are involved in the UAP sphere or, you know, more commonly known as the U.S. UFO sphere. I think we've had three congressional hearings on this so far, and Matthew Sullivan's case is extremely disturbing. You have an individual that was getting ready to come forward and testify before Congress about matters of incredibly sensitive intelligence value. So I think that the FBI has every cause to be highly concerned. And also Representative Burchett and Luna have all also been leading the charge on these matters, as well as Burleson. So you have incredibly credible people who are very, very concerned about all these matters. So this isn't something to be taken lightly or to be dismissed as crazy UFO talk. This implicates very, very real technologies and programs that have been attested to, you know, crash retrieval programs that have been attested to under oath before Congress.
Frank Milburn, on the heels of what John Nance just told us, why are you speaking out? Do you have any fears?
I don't know. They say jumping out of planes at low level is dangerous. They say getting shot at and blown up is dangerous. But, you know, I was doing that when I was 17. So, no, I'm not too worried for myself. I have had sort of harassment campaigns orchestrated against me. That's still happening. But, I mean, that's like stuff, you know, kind of like sticks and stones, just trying to make me out to be a bad person, trying to, the same thing as happened with Amy, trying to make me out to be incompetent and sort of, you know, lacking integrity, all those sort of things. But, you know, those, they're just water off a duck's back. I'm speaking out because Amy can't, although she can through the files that I have, and people are going to continue to hear her voice, and to see what she wrote and to understand more about her. Actually, in terms of the, you know, the sort of the anti-gravity and all the other sort of what they call the five observables, I actually, back in 2020, I wrote two papers on those for an Israeli think tank, the Begin Sadat Center for Strategic Studies. One of them is called the Pentagon's UAP Task Force. And the second one was American development of UAP technology, a fait accompli. So those kind of explain the strategic aspects of UAP and how, you know, both America and our adversaries want to harness these technologies, not only to compete with each other, but also, as Dr. Eric Davis said, who used to work for the Defense Intelligence Agency as a consultant, to, by 2050, to be able to approximate these technologies in case, you know, the tic tacs and the operators of the UAP turn out to be hostile. So, you know, as humans, we want to have those technologies as well.
If you know or believe you know anything relating to the now 14 missing and dead scientists, dial 800-225-5324. Repeat, 800-225-5324. We remember an American hero, Officer Stephen Arkell, Brentwood PD, New Hampshire, shot and killed in the line of duty after 17 years, leaving behind his wife, now widow, Heather, and two beautiful daughters, Kimberly and Lauren. American hero, Officer Stephen Arkell. Thank you to our guests, but especially to you for being with us tonight. Nancy Gray signing off for tonight, but I'll see you tomorrow night. And until then, good night, friend.
This is an iHeart podcast. Guaranteed human.